1964 marked the 10th anniversary of the unanimous Supreme Court decision which outlawed the racial arrogance of the separate but equal doctrine of pupil placement as a basis for public education in the United States. Our children, all of them, will walk one way into their shared future. 1965 will mark the 10th anniversary of the first explosive civil rights protest, the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. The American Negro is no longer willing to bounce along on the tailgate of American prosperity. The civil rights struggle is 10 years young. It has spread, and it is spreading. And we have been confronted daily in our cities and in our headlines with the history of this struggle. Its battlefields are well known, from Montgomery, Birmingham, Alabama, to Oxford, Mississippi, from the south side of Chicago to our own Board of Education building. The events have followed one another in kaleidoscopic fashion. We have read of the burning of crosses and the cindering of churches. We have read of the tens and hundreds of thousands who marched on Washington to state their convictions. We have read of governors who defied the federal law, but who could not defy the federal bayonet. We have read of cattle prods and of high-pressure hoses and of police dogs unleashed against hymn-singing Americans. What has happened, we know. What has been accomplished is not so clear. We have read of Ludlow and of blockbusting. We have read of the Freedom Riders and of the Night Riders. We are so close to it all that it's difficult to put it all into a perspective, to see if after these 10 years of challenge and response, of protest, nonviolent for the most part, and of retaliation, often all too violent, if after 10 years of struggle, America has actually moved any closer to a more open and a more just society. And so what I should like to do this morning is to step back, as it were, a pace or two, to see if we can gain some perspective on the events of the last decade. But even as I do so, I must remind you that we are not clinical observers, research historians who seek only to discover what has happened, as if we were marking down the history of some ancient struggle in Rome or Greece. I confess that I am put off by the sang-froid, the cold blood of the commentators and the analysts who can poll and measure and record and report as if they were not part and parcel themselves wholly involved in what is happening to our American way of life. I admit that I do not understand the psychology of the photographer who can watch an old man standing in a voter registrant line in Mississippi, watch this old man being attacked by some white toughs and not step in and stop it, but think only of the picture which he must send home to his editor. And I confess that what troubles me most as I analyze these last 10 years is that so many millions and tens of millions of Americans are still spectators. It's as if this was all happening in some faraway land to an alien people. It's as if we were watching a Titanic football match in our own Cleveland Stadium between the united supporters of the status quo and the United Freedom Movement. It's all very exciting. We might live from week to week for the rematch. We like to second-guess the quarterback and to suggest new players and new leaders for the coaches. Only, yes, we'd like for the good guys to win. But if we lose, psychologically, most Americans seem to feel that they can drive home in their well-heated cars and console themselves by bolting a drink or two. And there are no grandstands and there are no bleachers in this civil rights struggle. It's a struggle which involves all Americans. It's not a Negro struggle. It's a struggle which involves all Americans to see if we can still find that steadying, sturdy decency which has been the bedrock, the nourishing soil of our American destiny and of our American hope. How long do you think it would be if, chas v'chalila, the other side should win? How long would it be before all American freedoms were in jeopardy? How long would it be before the white citizens' councils had become Christian citizens' councils? How long would it be before those who now argue only for their racial privileges and their racial prejudices would argue that they have a God-given right to their economic privileges and to their economic prejudices? And how long before they would have erased from the law books the entire magnificent record of social legislation which has been the glory and the triumph of America these past 30 years? And then, too, the segregationist thinks in terms of black and white, of absolutes. How long would it be before we were out of the United Nations? How long would it be before a Strom Thurmond would have shouted us into a Holocaustian war? A man who cannot live on the same block with a Negro cannot live in the same world with a communist. No, there are no bleachers and there are no spectators. This is our struggle. Our entire way of life, our hope and the hope of our children is at stake. And so even as we seek to learn, to assess, and to evaluate, we're not simply writing a history text. We are seeking to learn what new energies we must commit, what new role must be ours, what new sacrifice we must make in order to see that this free and blessed land of ours remains blessed and free. How far then have we come? Certainly not far enough. Sheriff Rainey is free. And his bloody hands uphold the majesty of the law, at least in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And what a wonderfully misnamed town that is, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. How far have we come? Not far enough. Let's look at our town. Surely the case can be made that our city is a far more segregated community today than it has ever been before. Only 1.5% of the close on to 300,000 Negro fellow citizens of this city live outside the narrow confines of the ghettos of the East Side. In 1940, the Negro represented 10% of the population of the city of Cleveland. In 1950, he represented 17%. In 1960, 27%. In 1963, 33%. Twice that and more east of the Cuyahoga River. Oh yes, all of us have spoken much about and heard much about the Negro family moving in three blocks over. When a Negro family moves into the suburbs, it sends out shock waves which rattle the windows for blocks and blocks around. Do you know how many Negro men, women, and children, butlers, live-in maids, the sum total of all who have broken out, who have been able to move out from this iron band? As of June 1963, the last year for which we have statistics, 9,400. And that's all. 9,400 souls out of 290,000 souls. And you would have thought that the Germans had landed in England. And what is true in housing is true equally in employment. There have been in housing serious effort to provide mortgage money and homes for those who can afford to leave these segregated areas. But the Ludlows are submerged in the mass. And the same is true in employment. Many industries have opened up. The Urban League has had a skills bank. There have been all kinds of manpower retraining programs. And yet today, after all of these budding efforts, it remains true that Cleveland is not ready for the twin tidal waves in the area of employment which are about to overwhelm it. 60+% of the employed Negro labor force works in those industries which are about to be eliminated by automation. 40+% of the Negro population is under the age of 21. Statistically, over one half of these young people will not graduate from high school. They will not have the first employment certificate. The most minimal skills required to find a job in this increasingly sophisticated labor market. And how many have been retrained by our federal manpower acts and our Ohio State Employment Service and the like? We've heard much of these things. How many? 81. 81 men, white and colored. Cleveland has not yet come alive to the shock and the dimensions of the struggle and the challenge which we face. How far have we come? Certainly none of us can yet speak as Pollyanna might. But every day in every way, our city and our nation are getting stronger and better and better. And yet I would submit that we do not have to bow submissively under the iron words of the prophets of doom. We are not yet damned. There is, after all, the backlash that never was. There is, after all, the history of the tens of thousands of our fellow citizens who have joined hands together in freedom song and freedom march. And there is that magnificent philosophy of nonviolence which has been woven in by the grassroots leaders of the Negro protest, and which is its triumph, and incidentally, our national salvation. There are tens of hundreds of citizens in this city who volunteer their time in the war against ignorance, or in the war against poverty, or in the struggle for civil rights. For every act of ugliness, if we're going to make an equation, for every act of ugliness, there has been an act of citizenship. For every white tough at Sewinsky or Murray Hill, there has been a tough-minded white man who has involved himself in upgrading the Negro worker and trying to provide better education for the Negro student, and trying to see to it that our city alerts itself through the dramatically new dimensions of the age in which we live. For every act of ugliness, there has been an act of citizenship. But the equation needs to be completed. For every act of moral courage, there has been an act of silence and of indifference. As I review the events of the last 10 years, I am struck again and again with the thought with which I began. That most Americans want only to be left alone. It's all right. They should have their rights. But not on my street. Not in my union. Not in my club. Only let me alone. The average American still wonders at the common sense of the little slip of the girl from next door who leaves every morning to work in a settlement house in all that dirt and among that riffraff. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. And thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself if he lives next door, and if he's of the same color, and if he's white. As we assess the struggles and the changes of the last 10 years, one fact becomes surprisingly clear. And that is that such progress as has taken place at the two extreme poles of our national life. The level of the federal government and in the energies of the private citizen. Here in our community, we have seen the emergence of local leadership in the civil rights struggle. We have seen a spontaneous development of area councils and of block organizations. We have seen literally hundreds of improvement projects undertaken by churches and by service organizations and by ad hoc groups of all kinds. Citizens have given money and time and staff to experiment in new dimensions of primary education, of preschool education, providing libraries for our school, providing recreational facilities, providing in-job training and the like. The list is long and it's a noble list. And at the upper levels of our government, there's been change and change for the good. Put bluntly, in 1954, the most sacred right of our law, according to our courts, were the rights of property. By 1964, the courts had redefined the law to rediscover what the founding fathers meant when they spoke of the inalienable rights of men to life and to liberty and to the pursuit of happiness. Human rights had been given the priority which they deserved. In so doing, that whole web and network of prejudice, which had been sanctified by the law, began to be frayed and to slip away. A man could no longer say, if you sit and eat at my lunch counter, I'll call in the police for you're guilty of trespass. A man could no longer say, this is my home, and if I put it on the open market, I'll see to it that only those who are skinned the way I am can buy it. In the very historic decision of just several weeks ago in which the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the public accommodations title of this year's Civil Rights Act, a complete reversal of legal interpretation was capped, which stripped away from the prejudiced and the privileged the shield of legality behind which they had hidden, which had for so long shored up the way of life which they seek to perpetuate. And a very dramatic thing has happened. We can now have a civil rights change without revolution. To change an old way, the civil rights people no longer need to attack the system itself. The laws and the courts are on their side. There is recourse and redress. We can work hopefully to, and speedily, to evolve new ways and new social and cultural habits. And slowly also over the last 10 years, the executive and the Congress have responded to this new interpretation, this new understanding of the dynamic of American life, which was first seen by our courts. Segregation was outlawed, you'll recall, in interstate commerce, in the terminals and the depots and this train and plane and bus. Federal law has long been written to read that federal grants are to be given to institutions which do not discriminate in their admission policies, that federal contracts are to be written so that the work is to be done by plants and by employers and by unions who have non-discriminatory practices in being. Till the last year or so, these acts were largely print on paper, seldom enforced. now with President Johnson's executive order of a month ago. They are to be put into practice. The government is going to make the institutions which want to preserve their prejudice pay a high price for it. Hospitals will no longer be granted the Hill Burton monies, construction monies, and research grants. These are administered in a segregationist way. What is true of hospitals is true of schools. What is true of the schools is true of many of the matching funds which the government now gives to states and to counties for welfare and for relief. Builders who build only for the white market will no longer get federal housing monies and the like. Governors who want new dams and new irrigation projects, the pork barrel items which are so beloved, will no longer find these granted unless they can guarantee that their state governments and that the workers who will work on these projects are integrated, that no discrimination exists. The federal government hopes to price prejudice out of the market, and our hopes, of course, ride with them. So at the upper level and at the private level of the national life, there has been progress, dramatic and hopeful. What about the many levels of organization in between? State, county, board of education, suburban, city, the like. Here I must confess that there has been foot dragging, short-sightedness, indecision, and worse. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights struggle, the state of Ohio can still pass a reapportionment bill, one of whose major features is that it attempts to split up and dilute Negro voting strength. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights struggle, the state of Ohio can still maintain a financing for public education which discriminates against the large center cities where the educational problems are the most dramatic and the most urgent. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights struggle, the state of Ohio can still allow itself to be ranked 46th among the 50 states and the level of welfare and of relief which is offered to those who are unemployed. The sixth most industrialized state of the nation, our state, is 46th in its welfare decency. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights struggle, the county commissioners of Cuyahoga County in Wisdom assembled can still be debating endlessly with the school board in Wisdom assembled. Who shall pay the 15 cents a day which the extra poor of our youngsters require in order to take advantage of the federal lunch program? Days pass, stomachs are empty, and these wise men deliberate on. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights struggle, a suburban mayor is most anxious that an empty Veterans Administration hospital building in his area be used as a branch of the new Cleveland State University, less Chas v'Chalilah, it be used as a youth retraining center, and some of the Negro youth of the center city should sully the green streets of his all-white suburb. In this, the 10th year of the civil rights revolution, the school board of the city of Cleveland is still underfinancing the education of our young people, providing an education which is only two-thirds that of the state-stipulated minimum standards, which does not begin to take into consideration the cultural deprivation from which these young people come. And when private agencies and federal agencies move in to experiment, to set up projects which might act as guides and light posts. Our great school board drags its feet and finds reason to complain and spends a good bit of its valuable time in purposeless, acrimonious dispute with some in the civil rights movement. The city of Cleveland spends $389 per pupil per year. The state requirement is $500. Most of the suburban schools spend twice what is being spent in the city schools. There are today 160 empty places in the teaching staff of the Cleveland Public Schools. There are classes of 35 students and some of 40. And occasionally, some of more. In this, the 10th year of the Civil Rights Revolution, I'm afraid that as we look at our own community, we must say that for all the effort that has been expended by individuals, by all the leadership which has been given by certain fine civic groups, we are very much where we were 10 years ago, if not further back down the road. We are faced with new problems in employment. We are faced with new governmental tensions. Never in the past 10 years has there been a single elected leader in this city who has stood up on his hind feet and who has told the city of Cleveland what is needed, where we are going, and how we are going to get there and at what cost. We're still doing business, just as we were 10 years ago. And we cannot. Now, there will be pressure brought on the city from Washington, and there will be pressure brought on the city from its own citizens. You see that pressure, it's visible, it's protest. But none of our major problems have been solved. In the county, there are 104 governing units, 103 of them counter units, set up to move out from, to be away from the center city. In Cuyahoga County, there are 34 school districts, 33 of them counter districts, set up to be apart from, so that our children do not need to go into. In Cuyahoga County, There are 97.8% of the white people live outside the east side of our city. 85% of the white people live outside of the city itself. And they ask, for the most part, excuse me, not on my block, not in my union, not in my club. Well, what's for it then? Citizenship. Metropolitan government. The willingness to vote higher taxes for better education and better welfare service. Adequate state reapportionment and congressional redistricting. What's for it? We all have known for long. We need to update the creaking horse and buggy mechanics by which this county and this city is governed. We need to find new leaders, men of greater vision and far greater courage. And we need to find far greater courage within ourselves. Courage to involve ourselves not only in the individual personal service and help, which is so necessary, to involve ourselves in the civic undertakings which will make it possible for new kinds of government to be created, for new tax bases to be formed, for the many fine pilot programs in education and employment which have been established to be taken over and be financed by the county and by the city. The Federal Economic Opportunities Act is now almost a year old. Monies have twice been distributed for programs in cities around the land. It is an act, the poverty bill, which is designed to cope with one of the twin burdens of this twice-burdened Negro people, the burden of poverty, which imprisons them at the bottom levels of our society. And our city, typically, is still squabbling, bitterly, purposelessly, acrimoniously, about who shall sit on the board to administer this project. Every other major city in the nation has received money, the go-ahead. There are projects in being. And typically, Cleveland is fighting over personalities, engaged in the most stupid and meaningless, bitter personal debate. And typically, we are nowhere. What is needed? Citizenship of all kinds and at all levels. What is needed? Conviction. That conviction which will carry us through, because the civil rights struggle and the war on poverty and the war on ignorance will not be won next year or in 10 years or in our lifetime. We cannot have Sunday soldiers and sunshine patriots. We need men and women who will dedicate their lives to particular projects and stick with them and see that they are achieved and established and made whole. What is needed? Faith. Faith that indeed this great nation of ours is founded on decency and in understanding. That our founding fathers meant what they said when they spoke of human rights, of the inalienable right of man to life and to liberty, to the pursuit of his happiness. Such faith as will allow us to forgive errors of strategy, excess of speech, errors of tactic and the like. Such faith as will allow us to feel that the decency of America will indeed triumph. Because Americans will it. Because they will make it so. When Moses was about to die, he addressed his chosen successor, Joshua, and he said to him, Chazak ve'ematz. Be strong and be of good courage. And that is our commission now. Strength of conviction, courage of action. These are the twin requirements in this struggle to make America the land of our dreams.